If people in an organization believe they're in a mature industry with no growth prospects, they won't spend a lot of time and energy intensively looking for growth opportunities. If they believe others who do less than they do will get the same rewards, that belief will drain their energy. One of Dick Brown's first priorities at EDS was to change the culture by focusing on beliefs and behaviors. At a meeting of the EDS senior leadership team in January 2000, he asked people to identify the most critical beliefs that had shaped the company's view of itself in the past 5 years, and the beliefs most needed now for the journey forward. Working in groups, they came up with the following lists. Old EDS beliefs. We are in a commodity business. EDS is in a slow-growth, mature industry, computer services outsourcing, that has lots of competition, little differentiation, and thus inherently low profit margins. We can't grow at market rates. As the biggest player in a commodity business, EDS has difficulty finding profitable growth. Profits follow revenues. If EDS can get more business, it will somehow make money on it. This belief is a formula for misallocating resources. Each leader owns all resources. Control is key. Each division has total autonomy and safeguards its turf. This belief makes collaboration among business units impossible. My peer is my competitor. Like owning the resources, this belief is a major barrier to success. Internally competitive behavior is destructive. The competitor is out there in the marketplace, not in the next unit. Teamwork, sharing of knowledge, and cooperation are absolutely essential to winning in the market. People aren't accountable. It's not my fault. We know more than our clients. Our people will tell the client what solutions he or she needs. This belief prevented EDS people from adequately listening to their clients' problems and needs. New EDS beliefs. We can grow faster than the market, profitably, and using capital efficiently. We can increase productivity year in and year out. We are committed to our clients' success. We will achieve service excellence. Collaboration is the key to our success. We are going to be accountable and committed. We will be better listeners to our clients. The second list became an agenda for attitude change, not only among the top executives, but for all of EDS's leaders. Behaviors are beliefs turned into action. Behaviors deliver the results. They're where the rubber meets the road. When we talk about behavior, we are talking less about individual behavior than about norms of behavior. The accepted, expected ways groups of people behave in the corporate setting. The rules of engagement, as some people call them. The norms are about how people work together. As such, they are critical to a company's ability to create a competitive advantage. Linking rewards to performance. The foundation of changing behavior is linking rewards to performance and making the linkages transparent. A business's culture defines what gets appreciated and respected and ultimately rewarded. It tells the people in the organization what's valued and recognized. And in the interest of trying to make their own careers more successful, that's where they will concentrate. If a company rewards and promotes people for execution, its culture will change. Far too many companies do a poor job of linking rewards to performance. What's the problem?
While some leaders in some companies successfully make this link, too many behave like wimps. We have seen again and again that people love to give rewards. They love to be loved. But they don't have the emotional fortitude to give honest feedback and either withhold a reward or penalize people. They don't feel comfortable rewarding performance and behavior. They procrastinate, sugarcoat, and rationalize. Leaders sometimes even create new jobs for non-performers. As a result, the organization below is totally confused. At EDS, Dick Brown moved quickly to make sure the performers got rewarded more than the non-performers. Lack of accountability had been a major problem in the company, as the leadership ranks well understood. There were no negative consequences for poor performance, recalled one executive. Not only no consequences, but if you were part of the good old boy network, there really wasn't accountability for negative behavior toward the company. Added another, it was always somebody else's problem. Brown instituted a system that ranked all executives in quintiles by how well they performed compared with their peers, and rewarded them accordingly. It is similar to the vitality curve Jack Welch introduced at GE to differentiate A, B, and C players. Ranking people in this fashion generates controversy when managers design and execute the system clumsily, using it, for example, to arbitrarily force a certain percentage of people out of the organization. But if coupled with coaching that gives subpar performers the opportunity to improve themselves, it can greatly help introduce a results-oriented culture. The process has to have integrity. The right information must be collected and used, based on behavior and performance criteria. Leaders must give honest feedback to their people, especially those who end up in the bottom rankings. That is what Brown did. For example, he says, "In the first year, a person came to me and said, 'Your system doesn't work. Last year, I was rated really well. This year, I did the same work and achieved the same level of performance, but I was rated really low.' I said, 'Well, let me give you an answer. It is one of two things or both. Number one, chances are you weren't as good as you thought you were last year. Number two, if you were that good and you did the same job this year, you are rated lower because you didn't get any better, and everyone else did. You've got to realize EDS is improving, and everybody's got to improve the job they do. And if you are staying the same, you're falling behind.'" EDS also factors individuals' behavior into its rewards. Collaboration, for example, was important to the success of the new business model. But in the old EDS, there was very little collaborative behavior. So in the incentive portion of their compensation, leaders are now evaluated and rewarded in part on how well they work together. Suppose Bob, in one line of business, develops a client, then gives a client to Linda in another line, because her unit can better serve the client. His sacrifice will be noted in his evaluation, and his organizational leader will take it into account in setting his bonus. Salespeople get specific incentives for business that deliver to other lines of business. Whatever approach you use to determine rewards, the goal is the same. The compensation system has to have the right yields. You should reward not just the strong achievements and numbers, but also the desirable behaviors that people actually adopt. You should increase the population of A players, defined as those who are tops in both behavior and performance. You should remove the non-performers. Over time, your people will get stronger, and you will get better financial results.
You get what you measure for, and it's a straightforward process. At the beginning of the year, I write a letter to each of Honeywell's business leaders and staff leaders and say, "This is what we agreed are your goals." The first component is the financial goals, revenue growth, income, cash flow, productivity, or other variables depending on the nature of the business and what we're trying to accomplish at that particular time. The goals will be weighted according to the nature of the business. For example, if a business needs to develop 4 new products, I may lower the goals for sales growth and productivity and raise the goal for product introductions. The second component would be other goals focused on what we're doing both this year and in the long term. These goals could be anything from creating the Six Sigma infrastructure to breaking into a specific marketplace. We formally evaluate performance and potential twice a year in our management resource reviews, and then we link the results of the evaluation to compensation. The general manager of each business gives specific goals to each of his direct reports. They may all have the same functional goals, but they'll have different non-financial ones, building a stronger organization, working on diversity, or whatever the key issue of the day is. You want differentiation among options, among bonuses, and among salary increases. Differentiation is the mother's milk of building a performance culture. For the top 250 people, I use stock options. We stay competitive on base salaries, but anybody who wants to make a lot of money at Honeywell has to get it on the options. Here again, they're not an entitlement. For example, I've got a seasoned professional who's good at his job, but doesn't exhibit further potential. I'm going to pay him a tidy cash bonus, but give him a lower allocation of stock options and maybe none in stock grants. On the other hand, someone else seems to have a lot of potential, but if she didn't do as good a job in 1 year as I would have liked, I'm going to give her less cash, but I'm going to continue to motivate her with options because I think she's an asset to the company's future. We do all we can to reward people for doing their best. That's how we got a performance culture. Here's one example. In 2002, many companies will be handing out small bonuses or none at all, given the state of the economy. Our aerospace component was hit harder than most by the terrorist attacks of September 11th, and very few of its businesses will match the previous year's results. But we're measuring the people and how well they perform against their competitors in this kind of environment. If they do better, they will receive bonuses.
Linking rewards to performance is necessary to creating an execution culture, but it's not enough by itself. All too commonly, a tough new leader, striving for a performance culture, will set rigorous performance standards and then stand back to watch the play unfold. Sink or swim is the message. Lots of people proceed to sink, and the organization may sink too, as Sunbeam did with Al Dunlap. Other leaders design rewards for new behaviors of execution, but implement them brutally. They don't take the important step of helping people to master the new required behaviors. They don't coach. They don't teach people to break a major concept down into smaller critical tasks that can be executed in the short term, which is difficult for some people. They don't conduct the dialogues that surface realities, teach people how to think, or bring issues to closure. The missing part of the equation lies in what we call the social software of execution. The social software of execution.
How many meetings have you attended where everyone seemed to agree at the end about what actions would be taken, but nothing much actually happened as a result? These are the meetings where there is no robust debate, and therefore nobody states their misgivings. Instead, they simply let the project they didn't like die a quiet death over time. In my career as an advisor to large organizations and their leaders, I have witnessed many occasions, even at the highest levels, when silent lies and a lack of closure lead to false decisions. They're false because they eventually get undone by unspoken factors and inaction. These instances of indecision share a family resemblance, a misfire in the personal interactions that are supposed to produce results. The people charged with reaching a decision and acting on it fail to connect and engage with one another. Intimidated by the group dynamics of hierarchy and constrained by formality and lack of trust, they speak their lines woodenly and without conviction. Lacking emotional commitment, the people who must carry out the plan don't act decisively. These faulty interactions rarely occur in isolation. Far more often, they are typical of the way large and small decisions are made or not made throughout a company. The inability to act decisively, which translates into an inability to execute, is rooted in the corporate culture and seems to employees to be impervious to change. The key word here is seems, because in fact leaders create a culture of indecisiveness, and leaders can break it. The primary instrument at their disposal is the social software of the organization. Like a computer, a corporation has both hardware and software. We call the software of the corporation social software because any organization of two or more human beings is a social system. The hardware includes such things as organizational structure, design of rewards, compensation and sanctions, design of financial reports and their flow. Communication systems are part of the hardware. So is the hierarchical distribution of power, where such things as assignments of tasks and budget level approvals are visible, hardwired and formal. The social software includes the values, beliefs, and norms of behavior, along with everything else that isn't hardware. Like the computer's software, it is what brings the corporate hardware to life as a functioning system. A structure divides an organization into units designed to perform certain jobs. The design of a structure is obviously important, but it is the software that integrates the organization into a unified, synchronized whole. Hardware and software in combination create the social relationships, the norms of behavior, the power relationships, flows of information, and flows of decisions. For example, basic reward systems are hardware because they are quantitative. You make your numbers, the system rewards you according to a formula, and congratulations, here is a check. But if you want to reward other behaviors, your record with Six Sigma, or improving the diversity of your leadership team, or your collaboration with peers, software enters the picture because it defines the norms of behavior being rewarded. Leaders who create disproportionate awards for high performers and high potential people are creating social software that drives behaviors. People work harder at differentiating themselves.
A key component of software is what we call social operating mechanisms. These are formal or informal meetings, presentations, even memos or email exchanges, anywhere that dialogue takes place. Two things make them operating mechanisms, not just meetings. First, they're integrative, cutting across the organization and breaking barriers among units, functions, disciplines, work processes, and hierarchies, and between the organization and the external environment as well. Social operating mechanisms create new information flows and new working relationships. They let people who normally don't have much contact with one another exchange views, share information and ideas, and learn to understand their company as a whole. They achieve transparency and simultaneous action. Second, social operating mechanisms are where the beliefs and behaviors of the social software are practiced consistently and relentlessly. They spread the leader's beliefs, behaviors, and mode of dialogue throughout the organization. Other leaders learn to bring these beliefs and behaviors to the lower-level formal and informal meetings and interactions they conduct, including coaching and feedback. They become their social operating mechanisms, and so on down the line. Linked to one another and to the measurement and reward systems, the social operating mechanisms collectively become what we call the social operating system of the corporation. As such, they drive its culture. In the people, strategy, and operations processes, for example, the review sessions that draw the company's top leaders together are the main social operating mechanisms. The processes combined make up the social operating system. GE's highly developed social operating system is central to the company's success. Its main social operating mechanisms include the Corporate Executive Council, CEC, which meets quarterly, Session C, the annual leadership and organizational reviews, S1 and S2, the strategy and operating reviews, and BOCA, an annual meeting in Boca Raton, Florida, where operating managers meet to plan the coming year's initiatives and relaunch current initiatives. At CEC meetings, which run 2.5 days, GE's roughly 35 top leaders review all aspects of their businesses and the external environment, identify the company's greatest opportunities and problems, and share best practices. The CEO also uses the forum to observe how his leaders think and how they work together, and to coach them. A Session C meeting is an intense 8 to 10 hour gathering where the CEO and head of HR meet with the business leaders and top HR executives of each business unit. They review the unit's prospective talent pool and its organizational priorities. Does GE have the right people in the right jobs to execute its strategies? Who needs to be promoted or rewarded? Who needs help with development? Who can't handle the job? The CEO follows up each session with a handwritten note, reviewing the substance of the dialogue and the action items. Through this mechanism, picking and evaluating people has become a core competence at GE. The S1 strategy meeting takes place toward the end of the second quarter. Here, the CEO, CFO, and members of the office of the CEO meet with each unit head and his or her team to discuss the strategy for the next 3 years, including the initiatives agreed upon by the CEC and the fit between the strategy and the people in charge of executing it. As with Session C meetings, the CEO follows up with a letter to each leader outlining the action items they've agreed upon. The S2 meeting, held in November, is the operating plan meeting that focuses more on the coming 12 to 15 months, linking strategy to operational priorities and resource allocation. In between, other social operating mechanisms are at work. In April, GE surveys some 11,000 employees online for feedback on how well the initiatives are taking hold throughout the organization. In October, the 150 top corporate officers meet at the Crotonville Learning Center to review the progress of the initiatives, get operating plans rolling for the coming year, and participate in executive development courses. And at the December CEC meeting, among other things, executives set the agenda for January's BOCA meeting. This system of linked social operating mechanisms is how GE's leaders unite a company of businesses so diverse that people have sometimes called it a conglomerate. The social operating system explicitly ties GE's overall strategy to the performance of each unit, including its leadership development and operating plans. The dialogue, a norm of behavior created by former CEO Jack Welch, is honest and reality-based. Feedback is candid. And the CEO is present and actively participating throughout at every meeting. It's an operating system for execution. The contemporary corporation is complex, and each of its many parts is constantly in motion. Moving structures, moving ideas, moving decisions, and moving people all responding to a moving business environment. The social operating system is the constant. More than anything else, it provides the consistent framework that's needed to create common ways of thinking, behaving, and doing. Over time, it transcends even deeply rooted local cultures.
Our social operating system at Honeywell isn't as elaborate as GE's, but it serves the same purposes. All of our behaviors are evident in the people process, the strategy process, and the operations process, and at 2 management meetings where more than 100 of our leaders are in attendance. These meetings are where people practice these behaviors most intensely. From there, it cascades down into the organization. One of the most important things people take with them from the processes is the understanding of how to work together in constructive debate. No one person has all the ideas or all the answers. If we have a problem in one place, People will respond by getting together and finding a solution, not by sitting around and moaning that they don't have a solution or deciding to engage a consultant. We don't expect people to know everything, but we do expect people to get the best answers they can get, and they get them by working with other people. Practicing such constructive debates over time builds confidence in people to tackle unfamiliar issues as they arise.
The importance of robust dialogue. You cannot have an execution culture without robust dialogue, one that brings reality to the surface through openness, candor, and informality. Robust dialogue makes an organization effective in gathering information, understanding the information, and reshaping it to produce decisions. It fosters creativity. Most innovations and inventions are incubated through robust dialogue. Ultimately, it creates more competitive advantage and shareholder value. Robust dialogue starts when people go in with open minds. They're not trapped by preconceptions or armed with a private agenda. They want to hear new information and choose the best alternatives, so they listen to all sides of the debate and make their own contributions. When people speak candidly, they express their real opinions, not those that will please the power players or maintain harmony. Indeed, harmony, sought by many leaders who wish to offend no one, can be the enemy of truth. It can squelch critical thinking and drive decision-making underground. When harmony prevails, here's how things often get settled. After the key players leave the session, they quietly veto decisions they didn't like but didn't debate on the spot. A good motto to observe is truth over harmony. Candor helps wipe out the silent lies and pocket vetoes, and it prevents the stalled initiatives and rework that drain energy. Informality is critical to candor. It was one of Jack Welch's bywords. Formality suppresses dialogue. Informality encourages it. Formal conversations and presentations leave little room for debate. They suggest that everything is scripted and predetermined. Informal dialogue is open. It invites questions, encouraging spontaneity and critical thinking. At a meeting in a formal hierarchical setting, a powerful player can get away with killing a good idea. But informality encourages people to test their thinking, to experiment, and to cross-check. It enables them to take risks among colleagues, bosses, and subordinates. Informality gets the truth out. It surfaces out-of-the-box ideas, the ideas that may seem absurd at first hearing, but that create breakthroughs. Finally, robust dialogue ends with closure. At the end of the meeting, people agree about what each person has to do and when. They've committed to it in an open forum. They are accountable for the outcomes. The reason most companies don't face reality very well is that their dialogues are ineffective. And it shows in their results. Think about the meetings you've attended, those that were a hopeless waste of time, and those that produced energy and great results. What was the difference? It was not the agenda, not whether the meeting started on time or how disciplined it was, and certainly not the formal presentations. No, the difference was in the quality of the dialogue. In the typical corporate meeting, a business review, for example, the dialogue is constrained and politicized. Some people want to shade and soften what they say to avoid a confrontation. Others need to beat those they're talking to into submission. In groups that contain both types of people, which is the case in many meetings, dialogue becomes a combat sport for the killers and a humiliation or bore for the passives. Little reality gets on the table, and the meeting doesn't move the issues forward much. Now think of a meeting that produced great results, that got to the realities and ended with a plan for results. How did it happen? Dialogue alters the psychology of a group. It can either expand a group's capacity or shrink it. It can be energizing or energy draining. It can create self-confidence and optimism, or it can produce pessimism. It can create unity, or it can create bitter factions. Robust dialogue brings out reality, even when that reality makes people uncomfortable, because it has purpose and meaning. It is open, tough, focused, and informal. The aim is to invite multiple viewpoints, see the pros and cons of each one, and try honestly and candidly to construct new viewpoints. This is the dynamic that stimulates new questions, new ideas, and new insights, rather than wasting energy on defending the old order. How do you get people to practice robust dialogue when they're used to the games and evasions of classical corporate dialogue? It starts at the top, with the dialogues of the organization's leader. If he or she is practicing robust dialogue, others will take the cue. Some leaders may be short on the emotional fortitude required to invite disagreement without getting defensive. Others may need to learn some specific skills to help people challenge and debate constructively. These people should be able to get help. But the key is that people act their way to thinking because they're driven for results. If you reward for performance, the interest in performance will be sufficiently deep to sponsor a dialogue. Everybody needs to get the best answer, and that means everybody must be candid in their exchanges. No one person has all the ideas. If someone says something you disagree with, and you rudely tell him he's full of hot air, a lot of other people aren't going to speak out next time. If instead you say, "Okay, let's talk about that. Let's listen to everybody and then make our choice," you'll get much better responses. Leaders get the behavior they exhibit and tolerate. Once you understand social software, it becomes plain that no leader who's disengaged from the daily life of the business can possibly change or sustain its culture. As Dick Brown puts it, "The culture of a company is the behavior of its leaders. Leaders get the behavior they exhibit and tolerate. You change the culture of a company by changing the behavior of its leaders. You measure the change in culture by measuring the change in the personal behavior of its leaders and the performance of the business." To build an execution organization, the leader has to be present to create and reinforce the social software with the desired behaviors and the robust dialogue. She has to practice them and drill them relentlessly in the social operating mechanisms. For example, some leaders use regular conference calls as an operating mechanism to drive change in the culture by forcing new candor and realism into the dialogues and decision-making of the company's top leaders. The calls introduce accountability and follow-through. The leader's own behavior, including her communications with people at all levels, modeled and reinforced the beliefs and behavior her people needed to learn. The dialogue the leader conducts in these calls develops the total company picture for all to see. Everyone has come prepared to explain what will be done in the coming month to deliver on commitments if results are lagging expectations. By discussing the entire business and having a focus on the external environment, everyone participating knows more about overall trends, competition, issues, and roadblocks. If they are doing their job to help build a culture of execution, this information will cascade through the company. Can you create an execution culture in your own business if it's part of a larger organization that doesn't have one? If you try, will you become a social outcast? The odds are that you can do it, especially once you start showing profit and revenue growth.
You as a leader don't want to send your people out on Harry Carey missions, but I do think you can do it even if it's not part of a major corporate thrust. I always ran my reviews with the idea that you want to get the truth out. When I became a GE traveling auditor in the late 1960s, I visited GE locations all over the world, and I noticed a lot of different style of managers. Watching the successful ones and the unsuccessful ones confirmed my feeling that the more you get involved and the better you hash the issues out on the table, the better decisions you will make in terms of their resolution. These lessons stayed with me for the rest of my career. When I became a GE Capital Unit Manager in 1978, I was following these practices. But in that year, Jack Welch came in as Consumer Sector Executive, and he intensified this process dramatically. It was more penetrating, and it was more action-oriented, more what-are-you-going-to-do-about-it-oriented. He took what I had known and elevated it in terms of intensity. He gave the people process a depth and ardor and intensity that I hadn't seen before. The more experience I got as a leader, the more I brought that experience to the processes. In the people process, for example, when I started, my first thought was always to see how good a person was in a job. After all, that's what made the business run. As time went on, I still talked about that, but I also kept thinking, what is the growth potential of this person? I began to ask a lot more questions and get dialogue going on long-range potential. I also got more people involved in the discussion, because when you expand the audience, you know more. We used to have too many one-on-ones, because we didn't want something that was said candidly about a person to get out and be harmful. But we found a way to solve that problem. We acknowledged that the person being discussed was going to hear everything that was said in the room anyway, and we'd agree that we would be candid but professional. The conversations were still forthright, but they weren't damaging. We took care not to say anything about the person that you wouldn't say to his or her face. I was born hands-on and have always been excited about my business. I'm enthusiastic, intrigued, and curious about it. And that's what determines whether you can make these changes in your organization. If you find them troublesome, if you find them trying, they won't work. You've got to like the process, otherwise it won't work.
Success in executing a cultural change depends first and foremost on having the right people. In the next chapter, we turn to the most important job leaders do, selecting and evaluating people. Chapter 5, Building Block 3, The Job No Leader Should Delegate, Having the Right People in the Right Place. Given the many things that businesses can't control, from the uncertain state of the economy to the unpredictable actions of competitors, you'd think companies would pay careful attention to the one thing they can control, the quality of their people, especially those in the leadership pool. An organization's human beings are its most reliable resource for generating excellent results year after year. Their judgments, experiences, and capabilities make the difference between success and failure. Yet the same leaders who exclaim that people are our most important asset usually do not think very hard about choosing the right people for the right jobs. They and their organizations don't have precise ideas about what the jobs require, not only today, but tomorrow, and what kind of people they need to fill those jobs. As a result, their companies don't hire, promote, and develop the best candidates for their leadership needs. Quite often, we notice, these leaders don't pay enough attention to people because they're too busy thinking about how to make their companies bigger or more global than those of their competitors. What they're overlooking is that the quality of their people is the most competitive differentiator. The results probably won't show up as quickly as, say, a big acquisition. But over time, choosing the right people is what creates that elusive, sustainable competitive advantage. Dell ultimately outcompeted Compaq, a far bigger company, because Michael Dell took great pains to have the right people in the right jobs, people who understood how to execute his business model superbly. Nokia, a minor player in the cell phone industry early in the 1990s, became the global leader because of its people. Under the leadership of CEO Jorma Ollila, who had come from a bank to lead the struggling conglomerate, They adopted digital technology sooner than Motorola, then the dominant company. They also saw that the cell phone was not a communications device, but also a fashion item, and built excitement in the marketplace for their products with monthly introductions of new products. If you look at any business that's consistently successful, you'll find that its leaders focus intensely and relentlessly on people selection. Whether you're the head of a multi-billion dollar corporation or in charge of your first profit center, you cannot delegate the process for selecting and developing leaders. It's a job you have to love doing.
The most troubling problem I found when I joined Allied Signal was the weakness of our operating management team. It wasn't up to par with our competitors, and we were unlikely to produce future leaders because we didn't have any bench strength. When I retired from Allied Signal in 1999, I considered the greatest sign of our strength to be the extraordinary quality of our leadership pipeline. One measure of their quality was that several of our outstanding people had been recruited to lead other organizations, among them Paul Norris, who became CEO of W.R. Grace, Dan Burnham, hired as Raytheon CEO, Gregory Summey, CEO of PerkinElmer, and Frederick Poses, CEO of American Standard. That level of excellence didn't happen by accident. I had devoted what some people considered an inordinate amount of time and emotional energy to hiring, providing the right experience for, and developing leaders, between 30% and 40% of my day for the first 2 years and a good 20% later. That's a huge amount of time for a CEO to devote to any single task, but I'm convinced it accounts in large part for Allied Signal's success. One of the first things I did was to visit the company's plants, meet the managers, and get a feel for their individual capabilities. I didn't just talk to them. I talked to their people as well, to see how they perceived their work environment and how they behaved, both of which reflect the kind of job a leader does. It was during those visits that I came to see that the company's inattention to leadership development was a major problem. While I was impressed with my half-dozen direct reports, I was less impressed with the heads of our operating units and the teams they had built. Some of the managers simply needed seasoning and a few more assignments in different businesses. Too often, though, they lacked a well-rounded business foundation, so they set priorities from a functional standpoint. They didn't demonstrate basic skills like understanding the competition or developing their people. I'm not saying they weren't smart or didn't work hard. They had good ideas and knew how to present them, but they had not been prepared to execute. So we tried to give them generous severance packages and help them land on their feet. The next step was to vigorously recruit more able people, not only to run our businesses, but also to ensure that we could develop talented leaders in the future. Executive development needs to be a core competency. At GE, 85% of the executives promoted are from within. That's how good the company is at developing leaders. And it got so good because Jack Welch, and now his successor Jeff Immelt, made leadership development a top priority and demanded that all of his executives do the same. At Allied Signal, by contrast, we had to go outside for nearly all of our early hires, mostly to companies who had people development processes at the level of GE and Emerson Electric. Eventually, we were able to fill most jobs from within, which had always been my goal, but it didn't happen without a lot of my personal involvement in appraising and developing leaders. I evaluated not only my direct reports, but also the direct reports of direct reports, and I sometimes went even further down the organization. In my first 3 years at Allied Signal, I personally interviewed many of the 300 new MBAs we hired, whom we considered our future leaders. I wouldn't interview everybody, but I knew that the standard I set would be followed in the rest of the organization. You hire a talented person, and they will hire a talented person.
Why the right people aren't in the right jobs. Common sense tells us the right people have to be in the right jobs. yet so often they aren't. What accounts for the mismatches you see every day? The leaders may not know enough about the people they're appointing. They may pick people with whom they're comfortable, rather than others who have better skills for the job. They may not have the courage to discriminate between strong and weak performers and take the necessary actions. All of these reflect one absolutely fundamental shortcoming. The leaders aren't personally committed to the people process and deeply engaged in it. Lack of knowledge. Leaders often rely on staff appraisals that focus on the wrong criteria. Or they'll take a fuzzy and meaningless recommendation for someone a direct report likes. Bob's a great leader, the candidate's advocate exclaims. He's a great motivator, a great speaker. He gets along with people, and he's smart as hell. The leader doesn't ask about the specific qualities that make Bob right for the job. Often, in fact, he doesn't have a good grasp of the job requirements themselves. He hasn't defined the job in terms of its three or four non-negotiable criteria, things the person must be able to do in order to succeed.
In November 2001, I was having lunch with the head of a consumer products company and his vice chairman. The company had been losing market share, and the discussion at the table identified the source of the problem, weak marketing leadership at the top. The company clearly needed to hire a chief marketing person. It would be a make-or-break job for 2002. The CEO had someone in mind. She had been recommended by Mark, the vice chairman, and the CEO sang her praises, saying she's great, fantastic. In what ways, I asked. When he answered in glittering generalities, I pressed, and again asked why he thought she was so wonderful. Remarkably, he couldn't be specific, and his face turned crimson. I asked the CEO and the vice chairman what the three non-negotiable criteria for the job were. After some discussion, they named the following. Be extremely good in selecting the right mix of promotion, advertising, and merchandising. Have a proven sense of what advertising is effective, and how best to place this advertising in TV, radio, and print. Have the ability to execute the marketing program in the right timing and sequence, so that it is coordinated with the launch of new products, and be able to select the right people to rebuild the marketing department. After they articulated these criteria for the job, I asked whether the candidate met them. There was a long silence. Finally, the leader answered honestly, "You know, now I realize that I don't really know her." Neither the CEO, the vice chairman, nor anyone else in the organization had asked the right questions. To consistently improve its leadership gene pool, every business needs a discipline that is embedded in the people process. With candid dialogues about the matches between people and jobs, and follow through that ensures people take the appropriate actions.
Lack of courage. Most people know someone in their organization who doesn't perform well, yet manages to keep his job year after year. The usual reason we find is that the person's leader doesn't have the emotional fortitude to confront him and take decisive action. Such failures can do considerable damage to a business. If the non-performer is high enough in the organization, he can destroy it.
Several years ago, an industrial fine components manufacturing company concluded that it did not have enough bench strength in its succession plan. So it hired two CEO candidates from the outside. The company was number one in its field globally, with a long record of success. One candidate, Stan, was hired to lead its North American operations, the crown jewel of the business that produced 80% of the company's profits. He had come from a global electronics company in the same general field, where he had run a small business unit. He presented himself well, connected with people quickly, was hardworking, and made dazzling presentations. But Stan didn't do so well as head of North American operations. He missed his first year's financial commitments, he lost market share, and the cost structure of his operation became uncompetitive. The industry was suffering at the time from excess capacity, but Stan did not close plants, cut costs, or focus on execution. the company's margins and cash flow declined. And its stock price dropped like a rock. But the CEO took no action, feeling that Stan was still new and needed time to get into the culture, and that his coaching would put him on the right track. Then Stan missed the second year's targets. Cash flow declined again, and the stock price dropped further. The board became very concerned. After Stan made his next quarterly report to them, the board met in executive session with the CEO and essentially told him to fire the man, but the move came too late to save the company. By this time, the stock price had been cut in half. The company became an inviting product for investment bankers and a target for aggressive, acquisition-minded companies. Within 6 months, it was taken over. The CEO was very bright, a man of high integrity, always willing to give people the benefit of the doubt. He genuinely liked Stan, but he lacked the courage to confront poor performance or force plant closings and layoffs. He failed to make the leader of his most important operation face the reality of the industry situation and failed to hold him accountable for his poor performance.
The psychological comfort factor. Many jobs are filled with the wrong people because the leaders who promote them are comfortable with them. It's natural for executives to develop a sense of loyalty to those they've worked with over time, particularly if they've come to trust their judgments. But it's a serious problem when the loyalty is based on the wrong factors. For example, the leader may be comfortable with a person because that person thinks like him and doesn't challenge him, or has developed the skill of insulating the boss from conflict. Or the leader may favor people who are part of the same social network, built up over years in the organization.
The newly appointed CEO, I will call him Howard, of a $25 billion global company was aggressive, ambitious, and enjoyed great press. Expectations were so high that before he retired in a decade, Howard would take the company from number three to number one in its fiercely competitive 10-player industry. Howard asked all but three of the 11-person senior leadership team to retire early and replace them with people loyal to him. Everything went well for the first 2 years, thanks to the previous management's efforts. In the third year, the business began to fall apart. Success in this industry required frequent new product introductions, and Howard's team missed one deadline after another by 6 months or more. The company lost share in its highest margin product lines to foreign competitors, who brought their products out on time, and the delays had a huge impact on the brand images. The delays also increased launch costs by 15%, a serious financial penalty, because the business is highly capital intensive, with low margins. The company's cash position deteriorated rapidly. Its debt rating was downgraded twice, and it cut its dividend. Two of Howard's hand-picked direct reports were responsible for the increased costs and missed deadlines. A captive of his psychological comfort and blind loyalty, Howard would not replace him. Before the year was over, the board removed him and his team. The sharpest contrast I know of to this sort of behavior happened at GE, when Reginald Jones picked Jack Welch to succeed him as chairman and CEO. Jones, who was born in the UK, was cerebral, well-spoken, and considered one of the great business statesmen of his day. Welch was irreverent, blunt, worked from the gut, and loved to debate. On the surface, he was the opposite of Jones, but Jones recognized that GE had to change, and that Welch, who was smart, tenacious, dedicated to excellence, as was Jones, had the right kind of intelligence and personality for the job ahead. Welch's rowdy informality masked a well-studied and incisive mind and an unparalleled desire to win.
Bottom line, lack of personal commitment. When the right people are not in the right jobs, the problem is visible and transparent. Leaders know intuitively that they have a problem and will often readily acknowledge it. But an alarming number don't do anything to fix the problem. You can't will this process to happen by issuing directives to find the best talent possible. As noted earlier, leaders need to commit as much as 40% of their time and emotional energy in one form or another to selecting, appraising, and developing people.